You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Always feel like people are on a talk show and, you know, I got to do some little gimmick and introduction and just like, man, this is not a real conversation. I would not do this in real life at all. So
yeah, we just have a conversation.
Yeah, we're just having like two dudes just sitting down talking. Like if somebody came up and was like, who's this guy? I'll just formally introduce you. I wouldn't just say, you know, give you some big spill or whatever. That's just my theory on that. But other people, you know, they have their different ways of doing things, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, you just mentioned you're doing an elimination diet.
I am, yeah, which kind of interestingly flies a little bit in the face of kind of my approach to nutrition, because I'm actually a nutrition and weight loss coach, and the hashtag that got started a couple of years back was no FN diets, and no FN diets, because my company is Freedom Nutrition Coaching.
Okay.
And so that was kind of a joke that turned into a bit of a hashtag amongst my clients, is no FN diets thing. But I've had some digestive issues, upper GI, upper gastrointestinal tract, that is. So lots of like reflux and just kind of belchiness after meals. Mm-hmm. And then getting a little bit of bloating, like I'll eat certain things and look like I swallowed a beach ball. And, you know, I had a pretty good idea. Like, you know, that's usually going to be something like SIBO or small intestine bacterial overgrowth. But so sometimes in my business, actually, I subcontract to a nutrition therapy practitioner. So I bring her on with some of the cases when I'm working with somebody. I said, let's see if we can identify some specifics here. And so I said, hey, let's run this test on me and see what comes up. And so we put a few things in place, and I'm probably moving actually in the direction of slightly more restrictive, or I will be getting close to what's known as AIP or autoimmune paleo.
Oh, yeah.
And AIP is not intended to be, for most people, like it's meant to be a temporary intervention, essentially. And you can support it with maybe some supplements to do a little bit to take care of dysbiosis or kill off some bacteria in your gut or something like that. But really, it's intended to be kind of a short-term intervention to kind of give your digestive tract a chance to recover. And then, because it takes a little bit of time to clear out some of the inflammatory markers that occur when you eat something your body doesn't like. And so you give 60 days of AIP, which to some people drive them nuts. And to me, like 3 years ago, it would have drove me nuts as well when I was, you know, still struggling with my relationship with food. But then once that's done, you reintroduce foods in like a really small, like it sounds very tiny, but you know, you'd have like, let's say you're going to reintroduce egg whites and see how you tolerate them. Mm-hmm. You'd eat like a teaspoon of egg whites. And then 15 minutes later, eat like a tablespoon of egg whites. A really, really small amount, because you're going to have a reaction to it. You want it to be small.
Sure.
A couple hours later, maybe you'll eat one egg white, so like the remainder of that egg white, and then maybe a couple hours, if you're not getting any reaction, try again a couple hours later and just have like a full serving of it. And usually that means, okay, that one's not a problem food. And then you kind of just cycle your way through. And there's probably some foods that are better to start with than others. And so, yeah, I'm kind of going in the direction of gradually eliminating things. Kind of the last thing on my list to drop is tomatoes, because I love salsa. So I'm like holding out against salsa. Like, no, I will not give up my favorite condiment. So
have you always experienced these issues with food, or is this something that just came on later in like your adult life, or?
Kind of started getting reflux about two years ago. We did like 6 to 8 weeks with a PPI, with some medication, a proton pump inhibitor, just to block reflux. But at least in Canada, the idea is you don't take this for the rest of your life. Although I have a client who's been on a PPI for like a year. It's like, no, you take this for a short period of time. What it does is it blocks the production of stomach acid to give your esophagus a break. So it's like, let's stop burning that for a minute.
Yeah.
You know, let it get a break. and then reintroduce some things and actually just put some very simple physical interventions in place. So, you know, sleep on your left side, not your right side. So your stomach is lower than higher rather than higher, because it physically it's on the left side of your body, right? So if you sleep on the right side and you have food, anything in your stomach, it's kind of like you got a bag that's emptying downhill. Whereas you sleep on your left side, It would be a bag trying to empty uphill. Limiting your fluid intake before within an hour of going to bed, because, hey, if anything, your stomach becomes a little more fluid or watery, essentially, it's more likely to leak out of a small opening if your sphincter valve in the top of your stomach didn't close properly. So little things like that that I would have never thought about before. And it kind of just started with this feeling of always needing to clear my throat. So it wasn't so much the tightness and burning in my chest, but always got to clear my throat. So it was really my throat being irritated by this. So
just the foods was causing your throat to be irritated?
Well, what it is, like, it's the acid. In whatever is eating. Yeah. But then there's a problem with, let's say if you eat something like tomatoes or citrus fruits, which are acidic until they're digested. So now that acid, the acidic food, is going to run right over that irritated part of your esophagus and feel like crap too. Sure. Right? You're like, let's just rub some acid in this irritated tissue here, see how that feels. So you gotta remove some of the acidic foods as well. Coffee can be problematic, chocolate, partly because caffeine, or in chocolate, it's theobromine. That's chocolate's compound that's very similar to caffeine. They can cause the sphincter valve on the top of your stomach to relax. And again, stuff leaks out, splashes up, can give you a bit of reflux.
That makes sense. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Garlic, onions, you know, like the shallots or shallots. I'm not sure if it's shallots or shallots, but anyways, garlic, onions, chives, and what's the other one? Endives and leeks. There we go.
Yeah.
So that.
So, I mean, I've experienced with a lot of, well, not a lot, but it's a few different diets. You know, I don't know if you knew this, but I'm a CrossFitter. Then, you know, they're big on a paleo diet.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So I played with that for a while. I did Renaissance periodization. I don't know if you've heard of them. But I followed their lean diet at one point, and this was probably about 3 or 4 years ago, and this is where my relationship with food, I guess, started getting more serious, because it was more like, oh yeah, there's actually, you know, you got to realize what you're actually putting into your body and what works for your body and what doesn't. And I even, you know, maybe like it probably was last year or two, I did the carnivore diet for maybe 3 weeks, but I just couldn't handle just eating only meat and stuff. So that one didn't last long. But that was just another elimination diet right there. So
yeah, that's super interesting, because I'm moving more and more into the ethical omnivore style of eating, or nose to tail eating is another way of calling it. Oh, yeah. I've actually got some pig heart marinating right now. If someone's like wondering where do you start, it's like, don't start with beef liver. that's gonna be a tough one. But start with something like chicken gizzards. The name sounds really off-putting, but essentially chickens have this kind of like a second stomach, and they eat stones and gravel and things, and it goes into this gizzard and it grinds up, because chicken don't have teeth. It grinds up whatever they eat, all the stones and gravel in their gizzard. So it's this muscular bag. Now, if you don't cook them right, they come out like super rubbery and chewy and tough and awful. So I go in an Instant Pot and I cook them for 25 minutes in the pressure cooker.
Okay.
And they come out like, they actually taste a little bit closer to beef, like a dark, like it's a, it would be like a really dark chicken. But if you didn't know what you were eating, you might think you're eating beef. It's because it's a really dark and rich type of meat. And it's very tender when you cook it right.
What do you think about liver? I've never personally ate liver, I don't think, but That's where all the vitamins and minerals are really.
Oh, man, right? Liver is super healthy. Like, it's very nutritious. And people are afraid of liver because, like, oh my gosh, it's like the toxic waste dump. I'm like, no, it's not. That's what your colon is. The liver secretes the enzymes to break down the stuff and detoxify, and then through the hepatic portal vein, dumps it into your colon.
Yeah.
it's not hanging out in the liver. So liver is super nutrient rich. For me, it's a texture thing. Liver has kind of like this powdery texture that's like – And it's not even as much taste as it is texture. Like, God, am I eating meat? Like, what is this? You know, it really throws you, especially if you're just used to eating kind of fibrous, sinewy, like muscle meat. And so what I do instead is I take desiccated liver capsules. In the U.S., there's Universal Nutrition, and they make these liver tablets. And they're probably like 2 grams per tablet kind of thing of desiccated liver. And they're giant. They're like horse pills kind of thing. Uniliver, I think they call it. And it's pretty inexpensive. In Canada, we have a company called Trophic, and they make just like powdered liver in capsules. And my preference is for that, because they don't have all the binders and stuff like that versus these horse pills. But if you want to get a volume of liver, I'd say go with this Uniliver product. And that's another way to get that kind of into your diet.
Unilever. So you said that's like a pill or a supplement almost?
Yeah, it's a tablet. It's this giant jar of tablets. There's like 500 in there, and it's not very expensive.
I'm going to start making my grocery list right here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just because, you know, as far as nose-to-tail eating, there's the guy who wrote The Carnivore Diet or one of the books on it, like Paul
Saladino.
There you go. He was actually talking about that, and like he was actually promoting, I think that he has his own pill form where you can get liver and whatever have you on there. But if it's more, it was pretty pricey for what I remember. I was like, I don't know if I want to go down this road quite yet.
And I think that's what you find when you get somebody who, let's say like, what's that other really like Chris Kresser, the paleo guy, or Josh Axe, who's a chiropractor, Dr. Josh Axe. Not to knock his education at all, but it's like when you go around calling yourself Dr. Axe, but you're actually a chiropractor. It can be a little bit misleading. Now, that being said, look, the guy's well-educated. He does his research. He's got a team of researchers behind him. I don't know how like a chiropractor gets so famous. Maybe it's because he's handsome or something. I don't know.
That probably helps.
Handsome and charismatic or something. But, you know, he's got his supplement line. What was it, like Mark Sisson with Primal. I think he's got a supplement line.
Primal Kitchen, maybe?
No. Yeah, I thought it was like Primal Blueprint.
But, oh, that might be it too then. I don't know.
Yeah. So when these guys come out with their protocol and they get a certain level of notoriety, it's like, okay, now I'm going to produce a supplement line because I have enough of a following that knows, likes, and trusts me. But they're going to sell it at a higher price because, one, they probably don't have the scale of production yet because I used to be in the supplement industry as well. They probably don't have the scale of production yet to match some of the big supplement companies that have been around for a long time. But secondly, they get, it's like the Starbucks effect. Starbucks and say Dunkin' Donuts aren't selling something vastly different, but Starbucks, they just started naming their products differently, like a venti frappuccino, because we don't have an internal price reference for a venti frappuccino. Whereas you said, if you got a coffee with 2 cream, 2 sugar, you're like, oh, okay, I'll pay $1.50 for that.
Yeah.
Right. So by not having an internal price reference, you can charge a premium for your product. And by having passionate fans who support you or love your message, and that's why a lot of these figures are also very polarizing, because polarizing means that people are going to be more drawn, like people are going to reject you and get angry and whatever on the one hand, but on the other side, they're going to love you and get super passionate, you know. And so that's why I think you can get these supplement brands that are making huge markups on the products they're selling.
So you just said you were in the supplement industry. How did you get involved in that? And what were you
doing? My educational background originally is chemistry, and then I kind of got into marketing psychology as well, which seems like a really weird pairing, but I was just like, this is kind of a curiosity thing. I was like, psychology is kind of interesting. This is marketing. Maybe I'll go into business one day or something. Yeah. It actually started by chance. A former friend of mine had started a supplement store with a friend of his in the city that I live in. I live in Red Deer, Alberta, Canada. So we're kind of north of Montana here for the American listeners.
Okay.
That they had a falling out in their partnership, and I didn't want to see his business fail. And so on my days off, I was working at what we call the oil patch. So I was driving big trucks and operating heavy equipment, and so I helped him out on my days off. I worked a rotation of 15 days on, 6 days off, and I'd go into the store. And what would happen is people started asking for, hey, where's this John guy? Because I'm like well educated in chemistry, I've got a almost encyclopedic memory. I don't want to say encyclopedic because I do forget some things.
But I've got a head full of random information. Memory almost, you mean?
Not quite photographic, but I say encyclopedic. So I remember facts, numbers, details really well.
Oh.
I never studied in school. I would just show up and like write the test.
Oh, you're one of those guys.
Yeah. Yeah, like my last university exam, I remember I stayed up all night drinking Jolt Cola and playing video games and strolled into my exam, which is I'm not that cocky anymore. Anyways, so I would go to the store and I could tell people if they wanted, I could tell them what every ingredient and every supplement did in the store.
Wow,
and that's nice. Yeah, so then they'd come in. But so that kind of got me into that. And then the supplement reps started coming to me and being like, okay, well, what do you think about this product, or how would you adjust this formulation? And this is mostly for Canadian companies, so smaller companies.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, put me in touch with your, you know, formulator and I'll just have a conversation with them. And we would get talking about it. Now, you know, and then there's considerations you have to make when you're coming up with a formulation, because there's like therapeutic dosage. So like you could put 500 milligrams of something in, but if 3 grams is the effective dose, you're basically just, we call it fairy dusting. So nowadays supplements, because transparency is a really big thing and clinical dosing is a really big thing, that's why you see the prices of supplements going up as well. So anyways, I started just consulting with some formulators, and then we started looking at potentially doing some manufacturing as well. So we never actually ended up with a full manufacturing line, but we were sort of lining that up. But ultimately, actually, the business that I was in failed. Business partnership failed. It was kind of looking back, I mean, it was a toxic business partnership. I was in business with a narcissist and a sociopath who was a pathological liar. Yeah. And a lot of it was a shell. And unfortunately, I found out a little too late. And so that ended up costing me a lot of money. So that all kind of fell through. Which really sucked, because I was starting to really build up a reputation. I would go to like local raw ingredient manufacturers and stuff like that. We were setting everything up. I was buying bulk ingredients and I was making my own formulations. I was kind of like a mad scientist a little bit. And so that got me access to quite a few different companies and sort of what they do, which is really, it was really kind of interesting. So I was starting to really establish this reputation in the supplement industry. I think part of the reason why I was so keen on this, though, is really connected to my own personal story. I was struggling with my weight. And one of the big challenges I faced is, how could I be so educated and struggle with my weight? And I was looking for a lot of answers, you know, on like examine.com and supplement research and supplement science, to kind of avoid dealing with the real issues I needed to deal with myself and my relationship with food. And so supplements became sort of the thing that I became known as, the supplement guru.
So what do you mean you were struggling with your relationship with food? I mean, you just kind of ate what you wanted to. You just were you not working out then too, or you were just like drinking Coca-Cola, play video games, just chilling?
Well, there's a bit of the backstory there, and that is that I went through trauma a little over 10 years ago when I was living in South Africa. So I was nearly beaten to death down there, and so that was a pretty hard experience to go through. And I mean, it sounds like I'm sort of glossing over some detail, because I know we can talk about it later if it's of value. But the follow-up from that is like anyone who's been through trauma, like nothing really sets up your brain to sort of deal with something like that. And so I went from being like athletic to using food to cope with my trauma and basically suppress my feelings and things like that. And that kind of put me into a pattern of being a binge eating food addict. So the way that the brain works, I mean, it's let's say I'm feeling extremely distressed or under duress and, you know, reliving trauma and things like that. And then I start eating and it allows me to escape from my trauma. My brain's learned something. When I feel trauma, I eat food, I feel better.
Right.
And so that becomes a habitual pattern of behavior, even kind of hardwired. And so trying to break that, it can be really, really difficult without sort of addressing the emotional connection. So then kind of the next piece of the puzzle was, I went from like being athletic to being obese. And I really struggle with my sense of identity now all of a sudden, because who am I in this like huge 330-pound body when I used to be like a 210-pound athlete?
Sure.
And so that was a real struggle. And then what I say, like, what nobody tells you about being obese is, like, I call it, a fat cell is a gift that keeps on giving. In other words, once it's created, it's always there. You can shrink it and you can empty it, but it's always there waiting to be refilled. And if you're not mindful of what's going on, you will, you can rapidly regain weight. And this is what really discourages people and messes with their head. So for me, I had to wade into this kind of world of weight loss, what I never had to be a part of before, because, you know, I was an athlete, lifting weights, I stayed active, that kind of thing. And all of a sudden I'm like, how the hell do I lose weight? You know, cause there's a time when you kind of emerge from the fog of trauma a little bit and start to like find yourself again. And so it's like, well, crap, I've never had to like, how do I do this? You know, this is a whole new world for me. And so, you know, I went through the whole process of like macro coaching and just hiring different coaches, like bodybuilding style coaches. I was in the supplement industry. Like, none of them could seem to address what was really going on in my life. And I didn't even know what I was. I think the biggest thing is, I didn't know what I was looking for. I didn't know the help that I needed. And so I'd go to work with a coach and I'd just get frustrated and angry, because I'm like, you don't seem to get it. Like, you don't understand. And I didn't understand either. So I think there was that frustration that was partly aimed at myself as well as the coaches who were not equipped to deal with me.
Like, they didn't understand the mental part of it. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. And so it wasn't until about 2017 when I hired a coach, and he's a natural bodybuilder, looks like really good in his 40s kind of thing. So I thought, here again, I'm hiring somebody because I thought that I would be happy if I could kind of, you know, build a physique like he had, if I could lose the weight and kind of look like him. And I thought he was going to, you know, kind of show me some, I don't know, something that I didn't know. Yeah. And in a sense, he did. But he treated me differently, in a sense that he didn't like shame me. He didn't guilt me. He didn't try to coerce me. he kind of just let me, I say, wrestle with my demons in the light. So he didn't use, like, I would use my own struggles. I'd beat myself up. I'd get so angry at myself. I would try to push myself harder. You know, I was powerlifting. I was, you know, snorting pre-workout. I was jamming, jamming ephedrine. Like, I was sort of dabbling in, or I was getting very close to stepping into sort of the underground supplement world, because I have connections to that as well.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've been connected to the bodybuilding industry. Like, so I was really sort of heading in the wrong direction, I think. And I was also sleeping 5 hours a night and running, you know, trying to run a business for 14 hours a day kind of thing. So I was trashing my health, and I was getting angrier and angrier because my body wouldn't respond. And it's like, of course it's not going to respond, not when you're overloading your nervous system like that. And so then I started having the panic attacks and the anxiety attacks. And that's why around the time that my business failed and I lost all my money, like a lot of it. So had a whole lot of things go wrong all at once. And so really having a coach like that was just kind of like guiding me through this and being like, yo, just like, let's take a step back here.
This was all 10 years ago?
So this part here, the trauma happened 10 years ago.
Okay.
I struggled for about 6 to 7 years with like being a binge eating food addict. And then finally hired a coach, because I could starve myself. I could, you know, keto my way down, or I could, you know, intermittent fast my way down, or macro my way down, to lose a certain amount of weight. But eventually I would just erupt, you know, I just couldn't take it anymore. I would just burn out and just go back to eating all the food, because it wasn't addressing why I was eating the food.
Right. Well, so how did you find this? Just by that coach is how you just kind of overcame the mental part of it, and you just worked on yourself? And
yeah, well, I think it's that he opened my mind to a different possibility and a different approach. So I kept thinking that, okay, I need a supplement, you know, I need the supplement regimen. I need the certain workout plan. I need the certain meal plan. Like there's some piece of the puzzle that I'm missing. And truthfully, it was when he asked me the question, he said, you know, Jonathan, if you make a list of things you love and value, how far down that list do I go before I see your name?
Yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that one really kind of hit me, because it wasn't that I was like near the bottom of the list. It was I wasn't on the list. And wow. So he opened my mind.
Like, I like that. Sorry to make you
show. So I was like, flip, like men never talk about this. Like,
no.
You know, what does it mean? Like, I had no idea where to start all of a sudden. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, cause I'm also ex-military, you know, service before self and so on. And like, I was sort of the proverbial set myself on fire to keep others warm kind of guy. So how do I start this process of learning to love myself? Like that was a really, it kind of shook me. Because it really confronted like maybe everything I felt or believed about masculinity as well. You know, it seemed like the only safe emotion was anger. Mm-hmm. And here I was being given permission to feel other things, to actually like show myself compassion, which maybe I was viewing as weakness in a masculine sense. And so it started this kind of very interesting journey. So it's kind of like he asked the right question at the right time that just sort of unlocked something in my brain that goes, oh my gosh, like this is a different possibility that I've never considered before.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, just because, you know, you said you're from Canada, right? Right above Montana. How old are you?
Yeah.
If you don't mind me asking. I'm
39.
All right. And I'm 35. So, you know, it seems like, you know, with me, I'm in Virginia. So with me growing up, it was kind of one of those things that I wouldn't say, you know, every family is different, obviously. And I'm just generally speaking, but, you know, you wanted to be masculine, even around your boys and around your friends.
Totally.
You never wanted, you know, to show that if you were unhappy or sad or crying, unless it just actually just came out. And you, even then, if you were crying about something, you're trying to, you know, do that, like hold it in, cry.
To hold it back.
Yeah, you're like, totally. I'm cool, I'm good, you know. But I don't think that part was just never brought on me. But, I kind of learned it through time that, okay, yeah, you can show other emotions rather than just happy and mad. And
you know,
everyone's going through stuff, and you just never know what other person might be going through, just like kind of like yourself.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Like, we don't really choose our emotions. And so it makes no sense to sort of equate weakness to emotion. An emotion, nowadays I call an emotion like a check engine light on your dashboard.
Yeah.
You know, a little yellow light comes on, and it doesn't tell you what's wrong, but it tells you something is wrong and something needs your attention. Mm-hmm. And so my analogy here is that I was the equivalent of taking a piece of black electrical tape and putting it over the light on the dashboard so I couldn't see it. But the problem's still there.
Yeah.
And, like I'd been through trauma counseling and whatnot, and I'd kind of had an understanding of some of what trauma was doing to my brain and sort of what it would take to kind of work through it and so on. But it's like the path of sort of trauma recovery led me down this path of becoming like sort of self-loathing, self-hating, angry at myself. So I started to internalize everything and all of my struggles and my perceived failures, just because I felt inadequate. I was like, how could I know so much, be respected for the amount of body of knowledge I have and my ability to help other people, but I seem to be helpless when it comes to working with myself. And so, yeah, that was like this huge kind of paradigm shift and really changed how I work with people in my own coaching.
Well, if you don't mind me asking, can we talk about that? What happened 10 years ago in South Africa?
Yeah, absolutely. And for anybody I want to say, like, it might sound like I can talk relatively lightly about it, but it's because I've done the work. And I've moved past it, like I've worked through it. And so, we were traveling around the world. So my wife and I spent about 3 years as globetrotting nomads. We do a lot of traveling anyways, but this was like a 3-year dedicated living out of suitcases, covering a lot of distance all around the world. And one of the places we ended up was down in South Africa. Because when we'd been living in Mexico, we met a South African. When we were living in Poland, he actually came to Poland and worked with us for a bit. And then he said, come down to South Africa, work with my parents down here. They were running like a kind of internship for underprivileged youth. So basically teaching life skills, helping them become sort of more employable because their education system is a complete failure. The public education system in South Africa. It's kind of hard for us to imagine. Well, maybe not so much anymore. But I mean, like, yeah, down there, it's corrupt. It's just an abject failure. And so
I thought South Africa was more civilized, I guess, for some reason. Or is there only like one city in South Africa that's like a vacation spot?
No, it's...
Or am I thinking of something completely wrong here?
No, I mean, so South Africa, just give people some backstory. It's about 50 million people in South Africa. There's about 11 different ethnic groups that comprise the South African population. So there's 8 different ethnic black groups, as well as what they call the coloreds. That's the mixed race. And then you have like the South Asians, which is typically like your Bangladeshis, Indians, Pakistanis, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then you have like your English-speaking whites, and then your Afrikaans, which are like they speak Afrikaans, which is like a dialect of Dutch. So you have all of these different ethnic groups, and there's tension amongst all of them. So sometimes so South Africa is about 80% black and about I want to say about 7% white, and there's a mixture of like colors and so on in there. And this is the terminology they use. And so. Within each ethnic group, there's already tensions. Like people would think like it's a black-white issue. I'm like, no, it's an ethnic issue. The Zulus, you know, they hate the Tswana or the Pedi, or, you know, and so on, because they have major cultural differences. Because South Africa, a lot of the anyone living in South Africa didn't come from there. They all immigrated from further north and came down into South Africa and actually killed off most of the indigenous people that originally lived in South Africa called the Sambushmen.
Wow.
Right, so that doesn't make the history books, though, because it's, you know...
Yeah, you don't want to just put that in there.
Yeah. And so anyways, so they have... South Africa is massively corrupt. Their major political party is called the ANC, or the African National Congress. It's, quote-unquote, the Black People's Political Party. It was the party of... I think it was the party of Nelson Mandela. But now they've become extremely corrupt. And so there's a lot of issues where like money is just getting piled up in one corner and they're still pointing the finger and saying it's all these people's fault. Never mind, they're the ones rigging tenders and stuff like that and just ripping them off. And so it's a really, you could say in one sense it's civilized. Yeah, in a sense. I mean, like if you're smart, you carry a gun at all times, like 24/7. You have a 6-foot brick wall with razor wire over top of it, bars in your doors and windows. Panic buttons throughout your house, deadbolts on doors inside your house.
Damn.
You keep weapons by your bed. Like, you basically live in prison down there. And it's not just like white people that have to live like this. The black people live like this too, because the crime is so bad. But it doesn't get talked about. Like, Johannesburg is the murder capital of the world. There's something like, I don't know, 50 murders a day, like gun murders a day.
I didn't know any of this, dude.
Wow. Yeah, so if you wanted to be an ER surgeon dealing with gunshot wounds, you go to Johannesburg to train because there's so many people getting shot every day. Like 50 murders a day, that's not just 50 gunshot, you know, people getting shot. That's 50 murders a day, gunshot murders a day. So people thought like DC is bad. I'm like,
yeah, DC and yeah. Baltimore. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of light to that. Wow.
Yeah. You know, the stuff down there, like 1 in 4 women has been gang raped. Not just 1 in 2 women has been raped, 1 in 4 have been gang raped. And there is a cultural component to that as well. It's so we would hear that and it doesn't make sense to us because it's not how we grew up. So the South Africa you sort of see in the media, and believe me, it's a beautiful country and there's a lot of friendly, hospitable people there. Yeah. Don't want people to misunderstand. Everybody lives in this tension because crime is so bad and so high. Like everybody of every skin color struggles. It's not like a isolated issue. And so we were down there working on a nature reserve. So this is, you know, a couple hundred hectares or what other be a couple thousand acres kind of thing, you know, they got rhinos and giraffes and monkeys and stuff like that. Yeah. And there's an educational center there. So to kind of lay it out, you would drive through the main gate where they have rangers and stuff. You go down into the valley, come up the other side. It's actually about 20 minutes drive on the nature reserve. It's that big to get to where the educational center is. And you got like kind of buildings laid out in a line. So you got on one end, you have like a dining hall slash education facility. Then you have a dormitory where students can stay. Then you have like sort of washroom and shower facilities, and then tucked off to the side, kind of, so kind of in an L shape, you have an instructor's cabin. And so if you can kind of picture that L shape layout, so we're teaching our students every day. They live out there in the dormitories. We live out there in the instructor's cabin. And so one night I'm walking back from, everyone's in the dining hall. So on the far end of the buildings, the sort of cluster of buildings. And I'm walking back to the dining, sorry, the instructor's cabin, which is the furthest building away from any other buildings. It's in August, which is the winter time down there, the southern hemisphere, and it's dark out. And I'm in flip-flops, sweatpants, like it's, you know, we're in a great mood. We're loving the work we do, you know, really connected with our students. Like we really, really enjoyed what we did. And I get back to the cabin and the door is slightly ajar. And it didn't register at first because I'm thinking, you know, when we're out there, I'm like, hey, we're on a nature reserve. We've got rangers who are armed, all this kind of stuff. Like, it didn't occur to me that, you know, someone jimmied the door. And then so I open the door and there's three guys inside the cabin. And they're actually sitting down at the table drinking rooibos tea. Rooibos is Afrikaans for red bush. It's a common type of tea that's consumed down there. And eating rusks, which are these hard biscuits that you dip in your tea. And, you know, I remember looking at them and being like, what are you doing in my cabin? Like, it still didn't register in my brain that, like, something's really wrong with the situation here. And I looked at one of them and I was like, I know you, because he's one of the rangers. I didn't see the fourth guy who was outside the cabin. And, and then all of a sudden, crack, something hits me across the skull, like across the forehead. And this guy just cracked me across the head with a rock. So these three other guys jump up out of the table, and now they're all coming at me, and I'm like stunned because I just got hit across the head with a rock.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I remember like vividly the part that sticks out of my head the most is this guy grabbing. I'm wearing like a colored sort of golf shirt. Now, that's what I was wearing back then. And him grabbing like the collar of my shirt with one hand. And I look at him in the eye, and he's smiling as he's swinging this rock at my head again. And, you know, crack hits me across the skull again. You know, foreheads bleed pretty easily.
Bloody, yeah.
And so now blood is like streaming down my face, and I'm stunned. I mean, you get hit with a rock. Like, I was like stunned. Like, what the hell is going on here? Like, this is seriously wrong.
So the one of the guys who worked there was all in on it?
Yeah. What? Yeah, yeah. Wow. So they would have seen us passing like the gate every day, driving or every week, like driving into the nature reserve, and been like, there are these white guys out there, these white instructors, because this was a black on white crime. This wasn't connected to me. They didn't know Jonathan. They didn't know who I was. They just knew that there's like some white people out there.
So that was the only reason they just came to assault you. It was just that,
well,
because your skin color.
Yeah, they beat to death a farmer the night before. So. Wow. Yeah. And then they apparently they cut a hole in the fence, or I don't know, maybe the rangers let the ranger that was.
So you know, the rangers are just letting in their friends just to, if, you know, they give them some side cash or something. And
yeah. It's hard to know exactly, or, you know, and so I got knocked to the ground. I'm like stunned, you know, face is bloody. Like I'm like trying to figure out what the hell is going on, screaming for help. And nobody can hear me because they're all in the dining hall. That's like a few hundred feet away. Everyone's loud and talking and having a grand old time. And I'm getting stomped. And these guys are, you know, in one sense, it's probably a good thing that they wanted to beat me to death, because it bought me time, because they had knives. They could have just stabbed me to death.
Yeah.
But it's again, a cultural thing. So if you think about a power dynamic, this is them holding power over me, and they want to draw out the suffering as much as possible. They want me to suffer while they're trying to kill me so that I'm alive and aware that like they are dominating me.
Yeah, just give you a slow, miserable death, basically. Yeah, like a death of a thousand cuts, almost, or whatever it's called. Yeah.
So it's, you know, I the way that I would sort of describe it is, I was a representation of something they would have felt had historically oppressed them, and so they are destroying what they feel was historically oppressing them. And so, you know, thankfully I'm a pretty big guy, and. You know, I'm stunned and, you know, hollering for help. No one's coming. Not really sure what's going on here, but I managed to fight my way to my feet. You know, I managed to roll over to my onto my stomach and get onto my hands and knees and kind of get to my feet. And And then I was able to kind of took off, sort of stumble, crawl, run, you know, just get moving in the direction of the building. And for some reason, they didn't pursue me. I don't know why. And because they could have easily caught me and just carried on beating me. Yeah. And for some reason, they didn't pursue me. I got into the building and, you know, I said, I've been attacked. Like, I don't know how many are out there. And, you know, just like chaos kind of ensues because we've got 25 students in there. We've got another facilitator, as well as my wife and myself, you know. And they see, like, I'm just covered in, like, my face is covered in blood. Like, they said, the forehead bleeds really easily. If you've ever watched any MMA, see how easy.
Yeah, I've watched a lot. Yeah, I've seen it.
You know, and one of the, well, I had a cut, like, right under my eye. You can't really see the scar, but they just narrowly missed my eyeball with one of the hits with a rock that could have blinded me. So there's a lot that could have gone worse. Anyways, so we get ourselves barricaded in this building. We shot off the lights. We got, like, tables and a fridge against one set of doors, a tables against another set of doors. Like, I'm pretty stunned still. Like, I'm my head's swimming. Like,
yeah, it's funny, knocked out. I mean.
Yeah. They hit the thick part of my skull or something, man. Like, there's a lot of things that sort of kind of went my way in a situation like this. That's why I'm here today is what I'll say, which sounds ironic considering like they were trying to beat me to death. But yeah, the fact they didn't manage to knock me out, the fact they didn't chase me for some reason and that kind of stuff, the fact they didn't have guns because they could have just been shooting us through the windows, that kind of stuff. So my wife was like busy arming all the women with pots and pans, got them boiling water, like so we can throw boiling water on them if they run through the door. It's like we're arming ourselves for war kind of thing. And they're out there, they got like shovels and they're trying to smash the doors down. And again, we don't know how many are out there because they all travel in packs of 10 to 15 guys.
Right.
It's crazy. And so thankfully someone had a cell phone and managed to somehow, now the police are corrupt down there too. And so there's a lot of like, wow, you know, it just so happened that a senior police officer was walking by a phone that rang on someone's desk and went and picked it up. And they actually dispatched somebody. And so here we are. We're like, we don't know how many are out there. We're all thinking like, are we going to die? You know, how many are out there? If they break in, like this is war. We're fighting to the death kind of thing. Like we're trapped in this building, hoping they don't have guns, trying to sort of stay out of line of sight. Like it was just this, it was just a crazy sort of situation. We're basically being held hostage in this building. And so the thing is you can see across the valley. So when the cops start driving in onto the reserve, they have their lights on, they're flashing. Like you can see from 20 minutes away that these guys are coming. So these attackers just kind of melt into the bush, just disappear. Cause they see, okay, let's make our way out of here kind of thing.
Yeah.
They're not far away, but they've just disappeared in the bush and they're gonna be pretty hard to find cause they got a ranger with them. And, the cops show up and, they're just kind of took a look around and go, well, nobody died. Nobody got raped. So, all right, cool. I guess we'll just carry on. They're probably gone. And my wife was like,
"That's it?
Are you effing nuts?
Yeah.
like my husband needs to get to a hospital and get assessed. He's concussed and bleeding. Some people saw their faces. These guys tried to kill him. Like they're out there. They didn't just disappear on this 200 hectare reserve or however big it is, you know, like, you're going to take some statements and figure out what was, you know, and so on. And we're not staying here tonight and you are not leaving until we're all out of here." Wow. So my wife was incredible. Like she was so strong in all of this. Like she was, I mean, she must've been just like ramped up on so much adrenaline after all this was happening kind of thing.
Fight or you know? Flight, I guess. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so because of that, like she was like telling these cops what to do and they actually listened. It was crazy because these cops are incompetent. Like they found a knife and picked it up. She's like, you guys clearly don't watch CSI, you know, she's, you know, that kind of thing. Right. It's just like, they weren't even trying. And so anyways, we all got ourselves sort of off the property. But there's some things that of this whole experience that I look back, because this happened on a Monday night. It was August 15th, 2011. And I remember that morning coming out, going out to the cabin, because we'd stay in town on the weekend. And we came out to that cabin and being like, man, the cabin's kind of messy. We'll have to talk to the weekend facilitators and tell them, you know, maybe tidy up and don't leave the cabin in such a mess for when we come in. I think these guys were in the bush and they'd already ransacked the cabin once. And then they were kind of hiding in wait. Now that we think about it, we're like, do you remember there was a helicopter flying over the reserve that morning? There was actually people looking for these guys. because they beat a white farmer to death the night before. The cop said they smashed his head in like a pumpkin. And it's like, thank you for the visual. I really needed that. Yeah. So there were people that knew that there were guys out there who'd murdered somebody and they were hunting for it, but nobody thought to let us know as we're going out there with our students to be like, hey, there's some murderers on the loose here and we're hunting for them, kind of thing. Like, just all of these massive failures, but that's what happens in a corrupt system where a lot of people just don't care. You know, they're just there in a job to collect a paycheck and trying to avoid getting hurt. So,
yeah, I mean, if you did have a good cop, I mean, you know, and I support the police 100%, but if you did probably have a good cop come around there, I mean, then they're making themselves and their families just as vulnerable as anyone else there. So, yeah, they're putting themselves at risk just trying to do a good job even.
Yeah. You know, so like over here, I mean, I've got a ton of respect for police. I've put on a uniform. I served for 6 years in the Navy. Like anyone who puts on a uniform, I have a world of respect for any veterans out there, any active duty members. Like, I don't want anyone to misunderstand thinking that I'm disrespecting police, but I'm saying down there in South Africa, it's not the same. They don't have the same code of conduct. They don't have the same morals and ethics and things like that, you know? Anyway, so I mean, I basically got cleaned up at the hospital. I'm concussed. There's not much they can do, like, other than, like, you know, rest, take it easy. You know, you got your bell rung. They didn't fracture your skull. You're bruised, but they didn't break any bones. Like, I'm glad they didn't break any ribs. Like, how many kicks to the ribs can you take? You know, so, I mean, it ended sort of well, but I mean, so we stayed back in South Africa for like another 4 months, continuing on with this job, but we didn't live out on the reserve anymore. We drove in and out every day. We're like, we're not staying there overnight. It's just not happening. But we couldn't tell our students and other cohorts of students what happened. We weren't allowed to. We were like forbidden from speaking about this kind of thing. Anyways, so that's what got me on the path of like eating food to deal with my trauma. Cause you know, right after the incident, we're like, they don't win. They don't get to win. We're strong. We can deal with this, that kind of thing. But like my wife and I are living alone in this house in South Africa. And you got to, you know, after this incident, we're like, we're feeling pretty vulnerable and exposed, even though we've got a panic button. We've got private armed security that comes basically the push of a button. You know, their response time is under 5 minutes. And so basically one of us would sleep while the other one would be on watch and we'd sleep in shifts. So it just feels like you're living in a war zone, essentially. And, you know, one of the brothers of another instructor, he got locked in a building. They set it on fire and burned him to death. Like, you know, like stuff like that. They broke into the place, stole all the copper pipes out of the house we were living in. Like, they literally cut out all the copper pipes so we didn't have running water.
Yeah.
It's just stuff like this kept happening until eventually we're like, I'm going to kill somebody. Like, I'm legit going to set traps to bait them to break into my house so I kill them. Like, that's where I was going mentally. And I was like, we have to get out of here, because this is not who I am.
It's not
like, no, I'm like, I served in the military, but I hoped I never had to actually like take another human life, you know? And I think anybody, any like upstanding individual who joins the military is like, we want to serve and protect. We would like to deter like loss of life.
Of course.
And so anyway, we flew back to Australia, where my wife's from Australia. We flew back there and kind of went there to psychologically decompress from everything that happened, because I got work on like a cotton farm. But this time I was 330 pounds. Like, I was full on obese. And, but I was still, there's a lot of like denial. With trauma, you get kind of, trapped in that moment, and you're like, it's like your life, like a pause button's hit in your life, and you don't move forward with your life. We now understand a lot about PTSD. You know, you think back to, there's a really good book by Bessel van der Kolk called The Body Keeps Score. I believe that's the title. And it's quite a deep, hard, and heavy read, but it's incredible the insights it lends into like trauma sufferers and those who've been through PTSD and whatnot. You wonder why, like, you know, say a Vietnam War vet, for example, still thinks they're back in Vietnam, because their brain basically got frozen in time by that trauma. And so that was kind of what was going on with me and my brain. Yes, I was sort of functioning in day-to-day life. I could function with people. I could interact with people. They think they're interacting with me and that kind of thing. Well, secretly, there's kind of a hell taking place in my head, because with trauma, you relive the incident repeatedly, trying to rewrite the story. If I knew this, I would have done this, and so on. Really the feelings of terror, of fear, of like confronting my mortality, like, you know, am I going to die tonight? All this kind of stuff. Like, it was, and so I had enough sense not to turn to drugs or alcohol. But I understand why people do, because that's like that's an escape.
Yeah, it's so easy to get those too. And
yeah, I can't shut my head off. It's the only way I can make my brain stop showing me the things that I don't want to see. And so for me, that became food. And I kind of became like this jolly fat guy, I say. I kind of adopted this identity of jolly fat guy at a certain point where it was like I would show up at an event. People like, hey, John's here. Hey, we got some extra ribs, you know. Hey, clean these up, man. Hey, there's one more burger patty. Yeah. Clean it up, man. Yeah. We know you like this. So people out of the, you know, because we use food to show hospitality. Sure. But that's kind of what we do in the Western world. And people didn't realize they, because I was, you know, deeply ashamed of my behavior, but I felt out of control in terms of being a binge eating food addict. Like it's a compulsive behavior that's, it's hard to explain if someone hasn't suffered from it because it doesn't make logical sense because it doesn't come from a logical part in the brain. That's the thing. It doesn't. It comes from a totally different area of the brain. And so people didn't realize they're enabling my behavior when they're like, you know, hey, you just, boy, that dessert disappeared quickly. You must have really liked it. You better have another serving of it.
I think they're being friendly and, you know, like you said, but you're really, you know, you're suffering inside.
Yeah. So all of that is kind of the backstory. And really, so it was 2013. We kind of finished our world tour, I guess you could call it, and came back to Canada to live. And kind of from 2013 to 2017 was just this real struggle. Well, I mean, there were struggles before that, but even coming back to Canada to deal with my weight, and everybody would see me differently because the guy that left Canada, you know, in 2010 wasn't this fat guy. It was a, you know, 210 pound athlete. And the guy that came back was this over 300 pound, like guy that was pasty and puffy and stressed. And like, I wasn't the same person.
Yeah.
So try to reintegrate back, and like, you couldn't go back to even my old life in a sense.
You know, I was having dinner with a friend about 2 weeks ago, and we were talking about the brain and like getting impacts, you know, from like, well, basically we got on a conversation with, you know, football players and their injuries with CTE and like how it actually can change a person's personality with just that impacts. And even soccer players who are headbutting a soccer ball. I mean, do you think those blows to the head from the rocks could have like changed you like as far as personality and
100%. Yeah.
Really?
it's hard. I mean, because we never really think about it like before, it can kind of be hard to pin it down. But like, interesting, my wife used to call me the Tin Man. And it's not that I'm heartless, but like I didn't show a lot of emotion. So prior to that incident, but I think really a lot of it was just kind of suppressed because again, it had to do with sort of my perspective on masculinity, my views about it and my views about emotions and so on. And so I kept a lot of things hidden. Everything was very controlled. And after the incident, it became a lot harder to control things because these emotions, these feelings, the rage and all these flashbacks and stuff come out of nowhere and blindside you. And I wasn't able to control things in the same way. So I don't know if my personality was permanently altered as much as like I became an angrier, more frustrated person. But then I also tried to hide that from people because I knew that if they saw that side of me, like they wouldn't want to be around me. And I wasn't a very nice person to be around.
Yeah.
And I just have to give a shout out to my wife. We've been together for 16 years and she's never left my side. Like through all of this, she's watched me go from being like an athlete. She married this guy that had abs and athletic and strong and young, and to a guy that, you know, went through trauma and became obese and became, you know, she's never left my side. So I'm fiercely loyal to her for that reason.
You got you a good one, it sounds like, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I give a shout out to her. For sure, props to her. You talked about PTSD a little bit ago, and I wanted to get your thoughts on something. So when we talked about MMA a little bit. Well, we said about MMA. But anyway, I think, and folks, if I'm getting this wrong or completely butchered, don't get mad at me. But anyway, I think Johns Hopkins University is actually starting to do studies where they're actually giving people with PTSD psilocybin mushrooms just to help cope with that with PTSD, and I think it's actually starting to show some improvements in some areas. And I could be way off base here, but I think they are starting to show that there is some logic to it.
Yeah, so there is. So there's something really interesting about sort of hallucinogenic compounds. Even LSD, like microdosing LSD, is another interesting one. Mm-hmm. Because any sort of substance, there's a threshold where it can become, you know, harmful, or there's a threshold where there's a risk of abuse of a substance. I mean, you do this alcohol, you can abuse caffeine, you can abuse sugar, you can, and so on. There's kind of this hesitation to explore the medicinal properties or possibilities of these things. And there's like maybe some struggles around the morality of it, because, you know, normally, let's say magic mushrooms, for example, they're normally hallucinogens that you eat at a party to trip, not. But what I imagine is that they, and I don't, I can't claim to have a deep understanding of this, but what I sort of picture happening is it can drive like new connections in the brain. So the brain has, you know, this fabulous property called neuroplasticity, the ability to basically rewire itself. Yeah. You know, that's a really, it's incredible. And so I wonder if this, you know, you think about like when you sleep and you have these dreams and you combine these sort of, you'll have these dreams and you go, I don't know where the heck that came from. But your brain is like mashing together multiple stories and creating multiple narratives, and it comes out in this weird, wacky dream while it's forging like new connections in your brain. And I wonder if something like psilocybin is facilitating a process like this of neuroplasticity, where you're kind of rewriting stories and narratives and building something different than a different structure in your brain than previously existed.
Yeah, and that's one of the, you know, we don't have to go down this road, but we can kind of hit on it. But, you know, like with Stone Ape Theory, I mean, that's kind of what part of the reason, like if you want to believe we evolved or believe whatever you want to, but that's part of the belief that, you know, psilocybin actually made our, like you just said, rewire our brains and make us grow and actually just make us smarter. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah, I wouldn't be able to offer an educated opinion on that perspective. And so
I'm not a big, that's just about the basis of, I know of it, but anyway, it's, just, you know, and I think they're fun theories and they're fun and, but,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I like just gabbling into them and just, you know, well, maybe it could be some thoughts into that, but I'm still trying to figure out for myself, like what, you know, what exactly do I,
yeah, yeah, be open-minded and be curious, yeah, right? Because yeah, that's, exactly. You know, it's very often those who would go against, kind of like a mainstream narrative that uncovers something that's really interesting. I remember saying to someone, because I'm a former research scientist, and I just say, look, consensus is not the same thing as being right.
Yeah.
And it seems like in today's social media age, where there's kind of mob rule, you know, you say something that goes against a particular narrative that people are emotionally attached to, mm-hmm. it goes against consensus, and you get ridiculed. But this is, I mean, social media has only amplified this tendency in human beings. You look at scientists throughout history, you know, Galileo or Avogadro, or, you know, they came up with theories, and the sort of the elitist snobby scientists were like, no, that's not possible, you know, and ridiculed them and tried to get them shut down because they were, and you think like, why were they scared of sort of uncovering something new or novel, you know? But that's kind of what we see even happening today, is this unwillingness to be open-minded and think critically. And I think it's a problem with social media culture in particular. Think about what it does to the brain. Social media algorithms are based, like we live in what's known as the attention economy. So we want to draw people's brains in. We want to keep their eyeballs focused on our content so we can show them more ads and so on. This sort of pay-per-click model. It's the same with digital media as well. So because of that, everything that's the most emotive, that triggers the most primal parts of our brain, the fear and stress response that triggers us and makes us feel like we need to know more about this so we can keep ourselves safe. We'd actually think consciously about that, but that's kind of what's taking place. Well, that really creates, that's why there's such polarization and division, I think, in society today, because people are getting so emotionally triggered over things if they're unaware that this is the system that's built in place. Mm-hmm. And if you're aware of it, it still can be a challenge. You know, I look back at what I used to write on social media a few years back, and I actually go back and I've deleted a lot of my past posts because I'm like, I was dumb.
Yeah.
I was dumb and emotional.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd rather that stuff not be kept on record.
I'm 100% you know? With you. I'm 100% with you. I mean, that's just like last week. I think it was last week when Facebook went down and Instagram went down. And then, you know, if you, conspiracy theorists might say it was because that whistleblower came out and said, hey, Facebook's algorithm is actually there to actually make you promote hate and, you know, just wants to antagonize you to actually, and that's how they get that, your likes and comments and stuff. And then all of a sudden Facebook went down and it's like, oh no, that's not how it was. But they were more about, you know, the money obviously than I guess safety, I guess is a good way to,
I mean, now that being said, like I'm a student of human behavior and like really I focus on what I call brain driven weight loss when I work with clients in weight loss. So really I like to take kind of a psychology based approach to all of this. And so I kind of looked at this with a skeptical lens, and I said a true whistleblower would probably need like FBI protection, you know, from a powerful company like Facebook. And so I thought this one didn't totally pass the smell test for me. If anything, it felt like a little bit of a setup where like, ooh, you know, it's like a red herring. It like distract you over here with this whistle being blown while like Facebook is doing something over here that they don't want you to know about, kind of thing. Right. So it was like, make it appear as though, oh my gosh, like, and I was expecting sort of this contrite post to come out. And I think Mark Zuckerberg did write this like sort of contrite post or whatever. It actually read more like a propaganda piece, but you know, but it kind of just felt like that was a bit of a setup, like a soft lob to Facebook to be like, here, you can rehabilitate your image. We have this whistleblower come out saying these things, which on one hand sort of sound bad, but on the other hand, it's like, I think the whistleblower was pushing for further. I've never even read this story, but I'm inclined to think the whistleblower is pushing for like further censorship of discussion, like suppression of speech on these platforms. I'm kind of an advocate for open speech, which is probably a controversial position to hold. But my feeling is
free speech. I mean, I'm with you. Go ahead.
Because I think you need these idiots to speak their extremist pieces in the public square so they can be taken down. If you shut them out from the discussion, it's like if you cut out a man's tongue, you don't prove him wrong. You just prove you're scared of what he has to say.
I like that. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was Tyrion Lannister on Game of Thrones, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, nice.
So what happens is then you get the proliferation of these other platforms, right? And it's funny because I say a very minor presence on some of these other social media platforms because I'm like, you never know. They could become big. They probably won't. But like, you know, Getter and Gab and MeWe and what else? Parler and stuff. I think I have a combined audience in all these other alternate platforms of about 8 people. So I'm like, I joke about my huge audience on these platforms. But the reality is you're going to push discussion to another realm is all you're going to do. And you're going to push these people into an echo chamber. And they're going to, once they're in an echo chamber, it's going to amplify and you're going to lead to more extreme behavior. Whereas if you allow it in the public square where you can call it out and debate it and discuss it and so on, you're actually less likely to have extremism. Mm-hmm. The other part of it, I think, is when did we become like so fragile in terms of like somebody said something mean? What happened? Because, man, like you probably went through, I went through bullying. I'm not saying bullying is good. I'm not advocating for it. But there's something to be said for encountering adversity and building strength of character. And so, you know, interestingly, as a side note, I'm like, I have a 10-minute ice cold shower every day because I want to maintain a degree of resilience in the face of discomfort. And I feel like that's lacking in like our social media realm.
Have you, I'm glad you brought that up. So there's a book, The Coddling of the American Mind. Have you read that?
I've heard the title. I haven't read it, okay, but sounds like it'd be right up my alley.
So it's basically kind of, you were speaking on, like Jonathan Haidt, I think wrote it. And like one piece he's actually talking about was that, I forget when the year the study was done, but it was they were not giving kids peanuts for so long. And then they actually did another group of where they actually had the peanuts and they didn't develop any, you know, allergies to peanuts over time. But the ones who didn't get peanuts from, I forgot what age on, is why they kept getting allergic to peanuts. And then they started to develop other foods. But, yeah. And then they made a case for, and I don't know if this was part of the book, but then in another study they did was as far as bullying that, yeah, bullying sucks and I'm not advocating for it and there's should not be there. But they're saying should students or not students or just children or anybody actually have to go through some sort of type of bullying or hardship in their lives to actually, you know, find out who they are and come out ahead of it, you know, instead of just, okay, hey, I can actually fight through this rather than just let it beat me down. And then whenever I feel offended, I can just weaponize it, you know.
Yeah. Fun. Yeah. This, like, I feel like there's a loss of critical thinking for one and a loss of kind of resilience. And you pair that with our digital media environment that I do think is more emotionally and mentally stressful than ever before in human history. And so never before have our brains been potentially assaulted with like so much information. I say assaulted because like it's a 24-hour, like it's an endless stream emotive content that will be triggering our brain and feel overwhelming. So it's kind of like this powder keg, but it seems like the response is very infantile, like, let's try and wrap them in bubble wrap. But it's like, how does a muscle get stronger? It goes against resistance. How do we make our bones stronger? We put them against resistance.
Correct.
And so I would rather see us teach people how to cultivate character. And I think like character can come from like moral strength, like having a set of morals that you live by or values that you live by, that you make that your compass, because opinions of people will shift all the time. And when you try to make your compass the opinions of other people, you're always going to be missing the mark, and you're always going to feel lost and aimless and frustrated and angry. But when you make your kind of, you set your moral compass to this a set of values that don't change. Like if it's loyalty, honesty, integrity, whatever. Yeah. Like I say, my top two values are integrity and compassion. I try to filter everything that I do through those two values. They don't change. So I'm not changing what I believe because opinions of people change. It's like, did I act with integrity? Am I true to my word? Am I true to my beliefs? And did I act with compassion? And compassion is not a get out of jail free card, but it's like, did I seek to understand the human behavior? You know, before I pass judgment on what I see.
I like how you said that. That made a lot of sense. Yeah. I mean, I just don't know why it just makes zero. I mean, what doesn't make sense is that it seems like we can't sit down and have these type of, you know, discussions nowadays without getting, you know, without trying to find hate into it, where we can just have a civil. And even if, you know, even if you and I don't agree on something, I mean, there's no reason. Okay, that's fine. We can still sit down and, have a civil debate or civil talk about it. It's no big deal.
Why do we become afraid of that?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things that are going on now that I don't want to say in education, but maybe some politics, but yep. Even in the news, that they don't want to talk about certain things just because they're afraid of the backlash and like of losing their jobs or being being labeled as something that they're not, even though that they're an advocate for it.
Yeah. Well, if you want to take a deep dive into questionable territory, I came across something recently that I thought was really interesting. I don't recall where I heard it, but it says, when a tyrant fears an external threat, they masculinize their population. When a tyrant fears an internal threat, they feminize their population. Wow. I was like, that is a pretty interesting thought.
I like that.
Because what's happening in China and Russia in other capacity, China is like trying to hyper-masculinize their men. They've banned like feminine men.
Really?
Like you cannot have any. Yeah, they're shutting down. This. They had a culture based on sissy boys, which is like very feminine men. And this culture was growing in popularity. And China's put if they're authoritarian rule, don't take this as me thinking China's a good thing. You know, I think the CCP acts like a psychopath. If the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, was a human being, it would be a psychopath. No moral conscience whatsoever. But they put a ban on that, and they are actively trying to masculinize and hyper-masculinize their men. So what does that tell you? They're building up their armed forces. They're masculinizing their men because – like it or not, there's a biological reality that if you go into battle, like, and you try and put men against women, who's going to win? That right there, that statement could be deemed as, I don't know, hate speech or something like that. Just acknowledging a biological reality that men produce more testosterone, we have bigger lung capacity, we develop more musculature. These are biological realities. This is not hate speech.
There's just sides to it. Yeah.
Yeah, you go and ask my wife who spent 7 years learning self-defense, like, you know, would she rather go into a fight against a woman or a man?
I would hope so. Yeah, same.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she'd rather not be to fight at all.
Yeah.
But it's like, so we look at what's happening culturally in North America, and we actually see a sort of a very sort of feminizing of our population altogether. And again, people are like, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm waiting to like, you know, shady or sketchy territory here, sort of identifying this. But it's like we see a weakening of character, a sort of a demonization of masculinity when in fact masculinity is a really, or can be a really powerful attribute, contributor contributor to society. And we're seeing it sort of being torn down. And I say like, I feel like very new in this realm, but I feel myself wanting to be an advocate for what I call positive masculinity, because I think most times we hear that word, we hear the word toxic attached to it, sort of identifying unwanted male behaviors that aren't good. But I think a lot of these unwanted male behaviors actually come from like sort of infantilizing our population. They behave like emotional idiots rather than, you know, and there's one thing I sort of learned in traveling around the world is other cultures actually have sort of a transition from boyhood to manhood, where when you become a man in that culture, there are certain expectations placed upon you because you are no longer a boy. You are an adult. And in our sort of hedonistic culture where we're constantly pleasure-seeking, what do we got? We've got an obese population that wants to eat junk food and Netflix and celebrate everything but being strong. That sets, I mean, so that's going to bring about, you know, it sounds dramatic, but I mean, really kind of the like the U.S. is going to lose its, and maybe this is a good thing, I don't know, but their status as like the world's number one superpower is kind of on the brink, and it's sort of an inevitable fall off the ledge because the population has been weakened.
Well, that's part of, you know, you could say, you know, if you want to get conspiracy theory talking again, but that was part of like China's overall goal is to become the number one superpower. And
yeah,
there was some thing I saw or heard it on another podcast, but there was like a Christian Facebook group that was hugely big. It was very big, and that but if the moderators or the admins of the group were actually controlled, I think, were from Russia, and they were actually just Russian bots or something, and then it was all these Americans just full of this group, and it was just, what the hell are we getting into here? But
yeah,
I mean, that's one thing. I mean, I guess you could say if it's a strategy of war, but they're trying to get at us from the inside out, you know, and worth it, get us, so, you know, fighting against ourselves. And
yeah. And you know what? It makes perfect sense. I don't mean it's good, but I like to say that all behavior makes sense, right? So if you kind of look at through an understanding of the human brain and human behavior, you go, yeah, if I was this kind of person, that behavior makes sense, you know? And so if China wants to be a superpower, like China, like I said, China is a pathological liar, right? So mm-hmm. like, or the Chinese Communist Party, if it was a human being, would be a psychopath or a pathological liar without conscience. That's how they behave. They behave equivalent to a psychopath. And so this is why they lie about everything. I mean, China's in one sense, it's built on corruption and lies, and there's a lot, they're not nearly as stable as they might be made out to be. But it was kind of ironic that like there's people in China that laugh at Americans who watch the news because they're like, we don't watch the news. We all know it's propaganda. We're not stupid. Like, you haven't figured out that the news is propaganda. And so I kind of look at this and I don't like, in one sense, I'm kind of not bothered by it because I'm like, look, this is the ebb and the flow of humanity. I could sort of get worked up, get angry about this or try and fight. You know, it's like trying to swim upstream in like a tidal wave. Like, it's just not happening. Like, this is the direction things are going, but it's just kind of an observation. I'm like, well, when we like I am Christian, but I'm really moderate about it. I don't really widely publicize it. I kind of just go about my business. I don't belong to a denomination. It's just, I would say, like, it's a moral code that I try to live by. And I feel like I'm still learning every day in terms of how to live by this moral code, right? It's for me. And I would say it feels like when we drift away from some kind of moral code, which is really what's happening, a society would like lose its strength. And this is not to say that like there's plenty of wacky, like the U.S. is like the king of like wacky Christians. There's a lot of weird stuff that goes on there. I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't know where you guys came from. But, you know, so there's a lot of nuttiness that happens down there. But, you know, and the thing that maybe we could say about conspiracy theories is they grab our attention. I believe that most conspiracies are in plain sight. They're really boring and really unexciting, and they're happening in plain sight. While we think that there's some sort of, I don't know, secret cabal meeting in the basement of a pizza shop, you know, like, or that like a nasal swab for COVID is like putting nanobots into our brain. Like, if that was really happening, like, that would be like an incredibly terrifying reality. So the thought of that really grabs our attention because we go, oh my gosh, that would be terrifying if it was true that if I got nasal swab for COVID and someone put nanobots into my brain, you know, versus, they just slowly, just kind of creepingly introduce laws and omnibus bills that are 1,000 pages long that even the senators and Congress don't read. And then just this creeping sort of encroachment, like, that's more likely what's happening versus these crazy, like, wild conspiracy theories. I'm like Occam's razor. What is it? The simplest explanation is very often the right one.
Yeah. I never heard that one, but yeah, that makes total sense.
You know, I mean, obviously we've kind of spun off into an interesting direction here, and I'm kind of, you know, just kind of riffing on, you know.
That's fine. That's what we do on here. It's all good.
That's good. And I'm like, it's funny to talk about this because in the back of my mind, so here's sort of like censorship culture, right? I think about just expressing my thoughts, like even thinking out loud as I speak. And then a part of me goes, man, I wonder if saying this is going to get misinterpreted the wrong way if people hear this publicly and, you know, But we can't kind of live in fear of that. It's like, no, I'm just trying to understand human behavior here. I don't hold hatred in my heart towards anyone, including the people that tried to kill me. I even forgave them. Like, I never saw them again, but I went through the process of forgiveness because I wanted to be free from that experience. So I don't hold vitriol in my heart towards anyone, mostly because I want to live with peace in my heart. So I'm like,
you know, that's very bold of you. I mean, there's not a lot of people who could do that. I mean, I'm sitting there thinking to myself, I mean, could I ever forgive, you know, those three or four guys for nearly beating me to death? It's hard.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is really hard, but it kind of came down to this. I was in Istanbul, Turkey, where my brother lives. He's been there for about 12 years now. And I couldn't sleep one night. This was maybe about 8 months after the incident happened. And I realized, like, I was just tired of being angry. I was tired of every time I relived the incident that, like, the rage would come up and all these, because again, I'm really not a violent person by nature. I don't enjoy the thought of inflicting violence. I will defend what I need to defend if I have to do it, but I don't want to.
Right.
I'm really kind of a compassionate empath that hugs just about everybody that I meet. Like, that's who I am by nature. So I got tired of being angry, and just every time it would come up, I would just have these thoughts of just, and I would even, like, part of my brain would like the thought of me, like, enacting my revenge on them and, like, doing horrible things to them. And, but I didn't want this in my head. So I was like, okay, what do I have to do to kind of, like, break free from this? And really it came down to, I have to forgive them. And recognizing that forgiveness is not absolving somebody of what they did. They still have to answer for their actions. But it's me saying, like, I am no longer going to hold thoughts of, like, vengeance in my head towards you. You know, one way or another, you're going to live the life you live. And if they choose to live a violent life at some point in time, something's going to get turned around, and they're probably going to meet a violent end. But for me to not even wish that on them, ultimately, it meant that I was setting myself free. And I think I'm probably bastardizing a quote, but it's kind of like, you know, like, wanting revenge or holding hatred in your heart is kind of like drinking poison and trying to hurt somebody. And so the question is, like, well, how do you forgive? And it wasn't like an overnight thing. So I made the decision that I wanted to forgive them. And kind of the next step was, every time that these sort of the anger and the rage would come up in my head and these thoughts of vengeance, what I would do is I would actually try to cultivate a sense of compassion for them. So in other words, I would ask the question, what must have happened in their life to bring them to the place where now they're beating people to death?
Yeah.
Because this isn't how a normal human being behaves. This is how a damaged, traumatized human being behaves. Not a healthy, well-adjusted, well-fed, you know. So I'm like, this doesn't excuse their behavior, but at least helps me understand it. And if I can look at it from that perspective, I can then cultivate a sense of forgiveness for them. Because I really don't believe in my heart that people are born, like, violent racists. I think that happens as a result of some kind of conditioning.
Yeah, I mean, something where they, like you just said, you know, how they grew up, you know, what type of parents they have, you know, their environments. And, you know, I like how you said that, you know, you're able to forgive them over time. And just like you talking, I was sitting there thinking about that, you know, from my knowledge, that no amount of money ever bought another second of time. So you could just spend your whole life, you know, being upset and being mad. And yeah, you know, there's bad things that happen to everybody. You know, some things don't go well at work, or, you know, your day, or just whatever, your workouts, whatever. But, you know, you spend that time just being pissed off about it and upset, or you could just try to use that time to be more, to put it to use, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
But yeah,
it's hard for most people, and I get that. You know, I'm not saying
absolutely.
It's easy. Yeah, it might be tough for me. Like I said, I don't know. It would be really tough for me to find that forgiveness to do it. But could I do it? Yeah, but I don't know. Like, you found it. I don't know. I guess I'm just saying, I don't know if I could find that.
Well, the thing that I would say to people is, like, it's easy to sort of listen to this segment of a story that might go for an hour or something like that, you know, and go. But what we don't realize is this is spanning a number of years. Like, this wasn't an overnight process. This whole struggle that I talk about spanned like a decade. And so we live in a world where we're sort of conditioned for instant gratification. And it's like, stuff like this, there is no instant gratification. No. But the struggle is worth it. And that's what I, you know, like, when I work with people with regards to weight loss, I'm going, look, like, I want to tell you this is fast and easy, but I'd be lying to you. Like, this is going to be hard and it's going to be uncomfortable. But you're not going to be alone in this. And I think that's what's going to make a difference. So when you listen to us, like, I don't want people to think that somehow, like, if they're struggling with something like this, that they should just be able to the next day flip a switch. I'm like, no, this is a process. Like, it took time.
Oh yeah.
But I had a desire, like, I wanted more than anything else to kind of be free from the anger. Cause you hit the nail on the head, and I'm definitely stealing that. Like, no amount of money can buy a second of time.
I think Iron Man said that, or Tony Stark. So don't You can steal it from me. But that, I forgot which one of the movies it was, but I was like, yeah, that's so right.
Yeah. Bad things happen to good people. That's life. I mean, and so like I lost my life savings a little over 3 years ago with the collapse of our business. When I, you know, and okay, now I had someone who basically lied to me, manipulated me, took advantage of the fact that I'm an empath. He's a sociopath, like just played my emotions. And I didn't, because we don't go into like human relationships thinking this person's a narcissist or a sociopath or what, or a pathological liar. Like, I'm pretty open. I'm very friendly to, you know, and I sort of want to give people a shot and say that, you know, see the best in them first.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's my approach. Now, when it comes to politics, it's a bit different. I'm kind of cynical and jaded in that direction. But when it comes to just meeting somebody one-on-one, like I'm pretty open. And so I didn't go into this relationship looking for like the behavior of a narcissist. So I didn't even, that word wouldn't even have like entered my lexicon. And so it took a couple of years of being played emotionally. And my wife pointed out to me, like, the what's happening here isn't right. And I would defend it and be like, no, this isn't the person that I know. But with narcissists, they wear masks. They put on because they don't really have like emotions and feelings. They imitate it. And it's when the mask slips, it is weird. You go, who is this person? This is not the person. Like, it is really disconcerting when that happens. And you go, oh my gosh. This is a totally different, it's like, it's almost freaky because you see the real person.
Yeah.
And, but why I'm sharing this is, so I remember it was May 9th, 2018. So I remember dates pretty well. And a bailiff had showed up and put a lock on the door. He hadn't been paying the rent. He'd been putting the money somewhere else. I don't know where. And so I remember walking across the parking lot going, what am I going to say to my wife? Like, we got nothing. I got nothing. I got a mountain of debt. The money that I invested, I'm never going to see that money again. You know, this future we thought we were building, it's gone. What do you say?
Yeah.
You know? But weirdly enough, there was kind of this sense of, well, I have nothing left to lose. And so I might as well do that thing that, like, I talked about doing. Yeah. Because I could not go back to being an employee. Like, if I had to, I probably could have, you know, done something temporarily to make ends meet. But I just couldn't bring myself to going back to being an employee. Right. I was like, okay. And so that's what got me into starting to build my online business, was like, I'm going to build something that somebody can't take away from me. And ultimately that's what I did.
Yeah. You started from you got to the rock bottom and you decided, hey, you can either just keep climbing back to the top or like you just said, or just sit here and just take your licks.
Yeah. So these, I would not take these experiences out of my past. Like, some people would look at that and go like, you know, I wish I didn't have that happen to me. I'm glad it happened to me. Because I wouldn't be who I am today if I didn't have to go through that and sort of, and people might, you might think like I have this strength of character. Like, I'm, no, I found the strength of character. I think it actually lies in almost all of us. Like, human beings are incredibly resilient, more than we give ourselves credit for. But we're so rarely exposed to true hardship, at least in this part of the world. Like, as we were talking about before, like with, not anti-fragile, but like the coddling of the American mind.
Nope.
You know, and if I was to go back to my like younger me and have any advice for him, I would say you're stronger than you think mentally and emotionally, and you can handle more than you think.
Great words to live by.
You kind of have to get pushed to your limit to figure out what that is. And it's not going to be fun getting pushed to your limit.
That's what a lot of people do need, though. They just like, you, I mean, I love how you just said that, because a lot of people don't know their limits until you actually have to get down there and you get like you get pushed towards your limits, and then you find out what you're made of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you find out where you're lacking as well.
Yeah.
But here's the interesting thing. So I didn't know a thing about building an online business when I got started. Like, what the hell do you start? But I just started and I was like, okay, I'm going to start talking about this on social media, what I do. I'm going to tell people that I can help them. I've got my own story. I've lost 100 pounds. So let me just, you know, and when I started, it was more like I'd lost, I think, 70 pounds, like, and kept off about 70 pounds. So if I was to add up all the weight I'd lost, I would say I've lost like 600 pounds. But like, that's because I've lost and gained weight multiple times, you
know. Gotcha.
But this was like the permanent weight loss now, you know. And so when I finally hit the 100 pound mark, I was like, yes, that was like my big goal, to have lost and kept off 100 pounds, you know. I was like, so cool. I have this backstory. A part of me felt daunted because I'm like, I don't look like a fitness model. And so I'm not going to be posting pictures like in flexing my abs or, you know, squeezing my cheeks in Gymshark pants or something like that. You know, like, it's just, you know, like, just I don't have that. And so I was like, well, what do I do? how do I reach people when I can't use, like, it's not that I'm ugly, but it's like I don't have sort of this aesthetic physique that I can sort of draw people in with. So I got to draw people in. Yeah. So I got to draw people in another way. And so I started writing and kind of telling my story and expressing my experience. And it really stuck. Like, I was terrified the first time I wrote my story and was like, you know, hey, my name is John. Like, I'm a recovered food addict. Like, I used to be obese. I still struggle with my relationship with food. I'm not perfect. Yeah. And, but I feel like these struggles mean that I can help you. And the response was like massive. It was like, I thought in my head, going and telling people, sharing my demons, like, they were all going to abandon me. And kind of the opposite happened.
Exactly.
They were like, oh my gosh, you're human. You get it. You understand me.
Yeah. Like, he's a real person. We go through the same shit. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's a slippery slope here. And I just feel like I want to mention this too. And that is this whole sort of vulnerability thing. Intent matters when it comes to writing a vulnerable post. If you're writing a post, and maybe I'm speaking to my past self because I felt this slippery slope once or twice. There's a like when you write a vulnerable post, you can get a lot of love and a lot of sympathy and it feels pretty good. And you go, oh my gosh, like maybe I want to stay hurt and wounded because I get all this sort of love and sympathy and so on. So I wanted to be careful that when I write a post that's vulnerable, that I write from a position of strength and not of victimhood. And I think it's important if anyone out there runs an online business and is listening to this and thinks like, you know, how do I create content that will like speak to, you know, it's like, yes, you can write posts about vulnerability, but you don't want to set people up to just join you in a pity party.
No.
You want to tell your story and say like, look, but don't be a victim because a victim says I'm powerless.
Yeah, I agree 100% that, you know, you're just, I mean, because you see some of those things and you're just like, you just said, we're just joining a pity party here. But, you know, we all go through trials and tribulations, but it's how you overcome those. And then like, okay. I mean, there's nothing more than I love as, you know, either, well, I read about one book a month, but, you know, or a good movie where, you know, the guy gets the girl at the end after overcoming something. And,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, just like there's nothing but a better story than, you know, like boxers and athletes that come from nothing and, you know, they have to work their way up to get to the elite level or whatever. And it's just, it's a great story. And it's just like, hey, yeah, people can do this, but
yeah,
you got to like maybe change a few things about your life, change a few things about the way you think. And it can be done. It can be done.
Yeah. And I think that's why we share our stories is to say, this can be done. You can do it. But I almost dislike the before after culture. It's not that I don't post and share sometimes like before after pictures of my clients to demonstrate like social proof that I know what I'm doing kind of thing. But I kind of dislike that culture in one sense because it doesn't talk about between the before and after. It doesn't tell you the reality of the journey, that it's hard, that it's a struggle, that it's uncomfortable and so on. But it's also worth it. That's what I would say. And so, you know, for me, I've got a 7-month-old son and this kid, like his limbs don't stop moving. I say, I don't get snuggles. I get struggles. Yeah. Like, it's not that he doesn't like me. It's that he's so busy trying to get in and at everything in the mouth, like everything, you know, he wants to be everywhere all at once. He's intensely curious and he doesn't stop moving. So I realize I'm 39. I'm going to be 40 and this kid's going to be one. I'm going to be 41. This kid's going to be two. And these legs under him are going to get bigger and faster and stronger. And this kid is not going to stop moving.
Oh, yeah.
And so I say, I don't want to be a sideline dad. No. I don't want to be stuck on the couch watching him. I want to be physically present and active in his life.
Hell yeah.
And so because of that, this is why I keep going. This is why I get up and I jump on my bike and I go for a ride that makes my lungs burn and my legs burn. And my brain tells me you could quit at any time. And I go, I could, but I'm not going to because I need my conditioning to be better so I can keep up with this kid.
Yeah.
It's why I step into a cold shower, ice cold shower, and go, I don't like this, but I'm going to stay here because I want to cultivate this sense of resilience and strength because I want my kid to see a positive, strong, masculine role model.
I love it.
And so where I'm going with this is we need an emotionally compelling reason to be willing to be uncomfortable. That's what will push us into this place of growth, because growth is inherently uncomfortable. But when we have a reason why it's worth it. So for me, you know, I'm at Costco and I see a big old bag of chips and I'm like, I'd love nothing more than demolishing that entire bag of chips. Then I look at my kid and I go, do I want to be a fat dad on the sidelines? No, this is not, I don't say this to shame anybody. I used to be obese, but I'm like, I don't want to struggle to tie my shoes. I don't want to struggle to get off the toilet. I don't want to struggle to get up off my hands and knees. I don't want to struggle to pick them up.
Yeah, maintain your independence. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And so that's why I do it. I don't do it to have abs on social media. I do it because I want to be present in his life.
Yeah, and that's what he needs.
Yeah.
I know we're getting kind of short on time here, but I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, we didn't talk about culture and other things, but what's your thoughts on like diet culture, especially with your online business?
Yeah. It's a bit of a problem. And you could say with diet culture comes the counter revolution of health at every size and body positivity. And it's like the pendulum swung a little too hard the other way as well. So I take a stand against diets because diets say I will temporarily change my behavior to achieve a permanent result. Mm-hmm. Can't happen. So we need to break free from that idea. But somewhere we kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater where we forgot that actually like lowering our body fat percentage will do a lot for our health. It will lower our risk of illness. It will lower chronic inflammatory conditions. It will lower risk of heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and the dreaded C word, the other C word, you know. So this idea that health at every size got hijacked and infantilized as well. So yes, it's true that activity shouldn't necessarily be exclusive, that people should be able to, you know, participate and adopt healthy behaviors, whatever their size is. But there isn't a time coming where you're going to convince me that slapping another 100 pounds of fat on my body is somehow going to make me equally as healthy as I am right now. And so what needs to happen is maybe a shift in the language. This isn't really about weight loss. I say weight loss is a doorway. It's not a destination. When you understand that weight loss is, we have a number in our head that maybe we want to weigh. It's a placeholder for a future that we think we can live in, that we want to live in. A future where we feel comfortable in our clothes, a future where we're independent and we can do what we want because our mobility is our independence. Without that, like I have not met an obese 50-year-old who's body positive. You know, why? Because they got arthritis and heart disease and diabetes and they're struggling with their health and they're staring down the barrel of getting older and becoming a senior citizen that's in a scooter. Like, and so I think that diet culture in one sense is problematic if it shames people for where they got. We want to have compassion because I needed compassion when I was obese, but I didn't need enabling. I don't want people to say, you're fine the way you are, stay obese. That's a lie. It's not healthy.
No.
And so we need to compassionately take people to a place where this is not about a number on the scale. This is not about attaching your sense of self-worth to that. But it is about recognizing that your health is the only, like you only get one kick at this. And so if you don't take care of your health, you're going to live a shorter and less fulfilling life. Exactly. So that was a bit of an impassioned.
That was exactly what I wanted to hear because I could not agree anymore with you. I mean, that was awesome.
Yeah.
I say we just take it home on that one.
All right, man. Well, it's been an absolute absolute pleasure.
So if anybody wants to find you and on the internets and the social medias and all that, if you want to give that out, if you're not, that's
yeah, totally. Freedomnutritioncoach.com. So if you're interested in weight loss, or more than that, really, it's really about transforming your health. Like weight loss is just I see people come to me for weight loss, but that's like the cover story. I'm like, we're going to get to what's really going on and we're going to create transformation in your life, which is a totally different thing than weight loss. And the side effect will be weight loss. So freedomnutritioncoach.com. I do run I call it a live broadcast podcast a couple times a week. I call it Wellness Unplugged. But I run it live on Twitter, which is No FN Diets. YouTube, Freedom Nutrition Coaching, Twitch, Freedom Nutrition Coaching. I think I have one follower on Twitch. It's amazing. I'm like, hi, follower on Twitch, you know, Freedom Nutrition Coaching on Facebook. I don't do a lot on Instagram. I have followers and a presence there, but truthfully, I don't do a lot on Instagram because I'm not really a visual person so much, but, or you can just send me a friend request on Facebook, Canadian Nomad. So Canadian OMAD is my handle on Facebook. Just shoot me a friend request. I haven't hit the 5,000 limit and I'm a pretty open and friendly guy. So that's where you can kind of catch these. So Wellness Unplugged, the whole idea behind it is what I'm calling between the before and after. And the last episode I did was actually, it was really interesting. I chatted with a guy who's got very close to suicide twice because October 10th was World Mental Health Day.
Right.
And, if you want to talk about, you know, having that conversation about like this uncomfortable human conversation, that's kind of the stuff that we get into with it. But that's what I want. I want to have these conversations where we're not scared to talk about the human condition. So that's kind of what Wellness Unplugged is about.
I applaud you for that. Just those are very tough conversations, and I don't think I've ever experienced one of those. But just I've kind of wondered though if I could even handle something like that. But
yeah, no, I mean, and I really, the guy's name is Jeff Macalino. I'll give him a shout out too. You know, I said to him, man, like he's got a growing sort of stand up comedy career, but I'm like, man, you got more than just this. Because there's lots of competition in the world of stand-up comedy. There's not a lot of competition in, you know, talking about suicide prevention from that perspective and being able to bring some comedy into it, but just really humanizing it as a normal guy. So I'd love to see him do some good stuff.
For sure. I agree 100%. But all right. Well, I appreciate you doing this with me. This is very enjoyable. I learned a lot from you, and yeah, you've got a great story, man. I mean, this was awesome.
Oh man. Yeah, I love conversations like this. I had no idea where it was going to go, but we covered a lot of good stuff, and you gave me some things to think about as well, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yes, sir. And, yeah, if you don't have anything else, we'll call it a good night right there. So
let's call it a good night, man.
Okay, all right. Good news and good night, everybody. We're out of here.